Hello, and welcome to another episode of Roots and Hoots, a podcast project produced by the Legacy of Hope Foundation. Since 2020, we have been gathering, laughing, learning hard truths, and sharing in community conversations with Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island. Each episode, we learn something new, and we're excited to be sharing this journey with you. Roots and Hoots is about connecting with and celebrating Indigenous peoples' contributions to their fields of study, work, and cultures. We also speak with allies who share how they are furthering the work of reconciliation in Canada. To learn more about the Legacy of Hope Foundation and the work that we do, please visit legacyofhope.ca.
In this episode of Roots and Hoots, host Gordon Spence sits down with Kainai Blood Tribe member and assistant professor of sociology at Lethbridge University, Dr. Apoyaki Tiffany Heinbel-Preet. From completing her Master of Education and PhD in Indigenous Education, Dr. Preet brings a two-eyed seeing perspective to her work with the Kainai Blood Tribe to foster healing and knowledge sharing. Listen as Dr. Preet discusses her examination of intergenerational trauma, colonization, and their effects on the balance of the lives of the Kainai people, and how she incorporates the principles of beadworking into her research. Please enjoy this special episode of Roots and Hoots.
Hello and welcome to this podcast of Roots and Hoots. I'm your host, Gordon Spence, and my guest today is Dr. Tiffany Heinbel-Preet from the Kainai Blood Tribe of the Blackfoot Confederacy in Southern Alberta, Treaty 7. Hello and welcome, Doctor. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for inviting me to be here today.
You're absolutely welcome. Maybe we can start by telling us a bit about your background, a bit about your community and your family. And let's start from there.
Sure. I'm a member of the Blood Tribe, which is located in southwestern Alberta. And I grew up on an acreage just south of my reserve near the Canada-US border. And I have spent my entire life living within my people's traditional territory. And even when I went away to attend university, I still lived within my people's traditional territory and went to post-secondary institutions that were still on Blackfoot territory. So I feel very lucky that I have been able to have that opportunity to always live and work on Blackfoot territory, and that right now as an assistant professor at the University of Lethbridge, that I'm able to work and live there and be right next to my people. The city of Lethbridge borders the Blood Reserve. And Western researchers and historians, have recorded about the Blackfoot Confederacy and the Blood Tribe. And they tell us that we originally occupied the land from the North Saskatchewan River, east to the Sand Hills in Saskatchewan, south to the Yellowstone River, and west to the Rocky Mountains. And as I'm engaged in dialogue with my tribal members and my elders who tell me that our traditional territory actually extended further beyond this, as high as high level in northern Alberta. And I have a fellow Blackfoot Confederacy member, Suda Collinglass, who's doing some very interesting work creating an interactive map on Google Earth, where she's found Blackfoot historical and sacred sites far south than what historians have been telling us in the United States and in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming.
Right, I heard that I was reading, I think it's probably when I was in your community, Kainai, they were telling us that some of your territory actually extends into Montana and to the United States, your traditional territory anyway. Mm-hmm. And the Blackfoot Confederacy is actually in parts of the Blackfoot people are in the United States. Is that true?
Yes. That correct? Yeah. In Canada and the United States.
Yeah. growing up in Kainai, and were you taught your traditional language? I'm sure you were, you understand and grew up with the culture of your people. But how was the language thing? Did you learn to speak your language?
So when I was growing up, I had both Blackfoot and English spoken in my home, and so I think that I understood it better when I was younger. My mom tells me stories about when I was very little that my grandmother would speak to me in fluent Blackfoot, and that I would do what she was asking me to do. And sometimes I would respond in English. But then as I grew up, the only education that was available to me was public education. And so when I went into public school, the administrators really stressed that we needed to be speaking English and that we shouldn't have Blackfoot in the home. And that was a message that they would send letters home every year, reminding our parents that if they wanted us to be successful in our education endeavors, that we needed to only speak English. And so I didn't have as many opportunities to practice and learn my Blackfoot language. So I speak it a little. I definitely want to become fluent and learn more in my Blackfoot language.
So the school system actually discouraged you and your family, your parents, not to speak Blackfoot in your home?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They sent letters home every year saying that they were disadvantaging us if we spoke Blackfoot in the home and that we needed to speak English.
Wow, that's incredible. And here, at least today anyway, people are struggling to maintain their traditional Indigenous languages across Canada. And to hear something like that is really, you know, it's just, I find it amazing that people were actually doing that not too long ago. So you're a member of they call the Kainai Blood Tribe, which is part of the Blackfoot Confederacy. Such deep roots in the Great Plains area. Can you please share your knowledge about the Confederacy? What's
Sure.
the Confederacy about?
The Confederacy, we're comprised of four tribes. So we have Siksika, which is the Blackfoot tribe, and it's located by the city of Calgary. We have Bigeni, which is located in southwestern Alberta near Pincher Creek. And we've got Kainai, which is where I'm from, the Blood Tribe, and that's also in southern Alberta and by the city of Lethbridge. And then we have Amskapi Bigeni, which is located in the United States in the province or the state of Montana. And my Blackfoot tribe, so the Blood Tribe, we're located next to the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, right next to Chief Mountain. We're about 20 minutes north of the Canada-US border. We have the largest land base reserve in Canada. We're almost 1,500 square kilometers, and we have a band membership of nearly 13,000 members.
Right. I find the Chief Mountain is a very interesting mountain. And when you're in Kainai, you could see it. Like, it's such a beautiful big mountain, and your culture, your people are tied to that mountain, right? Historically, it's almost like, you know, a grandfather to you. And tell us a little bit about your relationship with that mountain.
I always know that I'm home when I can see Chief Mountain, and so it's always a really beautiful sight to be able to behold. And we call it Ninastago, which means Chief Mountain, and we've been taught that it looks like a chief that is lying down. And so when we take a look at the profile, it's supposed to look like a man who's laying down in the mountain. So you can see his profile starting from the left to right. You would see his chin, his nose, and his feather headdress. So it's a very special and sacred place to the Blackfoot people.
Yeah. I understand that you have some ceremonies up there, and it's quite a huge mountain. And how do people get up there? And
The entrance is actually in the States with the Amskapi Bigeni. And so so technically you would need to get permission from Amskapi Bigeni to go up there. And I've heard in recent years they've been trying to to protect it. So that, you know, there's a lot of tourists who come and litter and don't really take care of it the way that they should. And
Right.
so they've been trying to find ways to still protect the land and be able to have access for Blackfoot members who want to go and be in that space.
Yeah. Do you have ceremonies up there?
Some people will do that. Some people will hike up to the top of Chief Mountain as well. So
yeah, how long would that take to hike up there? It's quite a big mountain.
Right, almost a day. It's something that I haven't done, but I want to do. It's on my bucket list of things to do in my life.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to make it up there.
Wow. Yeah, that's got to be an amazing, amazing experience to do that, and to experience a ceremony up there. You know, that's definitely on somebody's bucket list. I'd like to put it on mine, but I don't know if that'll ever happen. But so maybe someday I'll get a chance to travel out there and do that. But I don't know if I can hike that long, that far up the mountain at my age anyway. Your work focuses on, now it's focusing on implementing the Truth and Reconciliation's call to action on the Blood Reserve. That's pretty incredible. How does this work exactly? How's this been going for you?
So I didn't grow up attending a residential school. I'm an intergenerational survivor of the residential school system, and
You did or you didn't?
did not. So
Okay.
I'm intergenerational
Yeah.
survivor. So my mother, my aunties, uncles, grandparents all went to residential school.
Yeah.
And it's been one of the greatest mysteries, I think, where I didn't attend it. And you didn't really grow up learning about what happened, and your family members didn't really talk about it. And in my public education, we weren't taught about residential schools, but it was something that I could tell profoundly impacted my family members and my tribal members. And so it was something that I felt was really important to understand what has happened to us, and in order to be able to work on our healing journey. And so I'd been kind of working in the area of taking a look at the history of colonization and residential schools prior to the Truth and Reconciliation coming out, and I found it really hard to get into archives and archives being willing to share documents. And after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada came out with its calls to action, I found it much easier to work with different museums and archives to take a look at documents. And so this was something that I really wanted to be able to take a look at. And I got permission from my chief and council to look into the history of colonization as it pertains to the colonial school system. And I've been traveling across Canada to collect primary and secondary documents that was written by the Canadian government, the different government officials and missionaries who opened up schools on the Blood Reserve. And so collecting those documents and then taking them back into my community and working with elders from my community to go through these documents, to go through the photographs, and to go through the policies that the Canadian government enacted on the Blood people, so that we are able to tell this time period from a Blackfoot perspective, because a lot of history gets told by a Eurocentric point of view. And I wanted to hear what my people had to say and what their experiences were during this time. And I think it's really important to be able to share that and tell those stories.
Ayaya songs are about our histories. Ayaya is an Inuit-owned firm that tells our stories in many languages across Canada. They are experts in publishing children's books, usually in syllabics, and they also do large multi-language projects like the reports of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission. If you need help getting your stories into classrooms or homes in Cree, Inuktitut, or other Indigenous languages, check them out at ayaya.ca. That's ayaya.ca.
That must be interesting to read what some of your people have to say of their time at residential schools. What are some things you found out, you heard, read about?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest findings that I've come to understand from the research that I've been conducting is that there's so much more that the Canadian government did in addition to residential schools. So there were multiple school models that the Canadian government used to try and assimilate Indigenous children. Residential schools was just one of those models. There were several other models. And the Canadian government did that because the earlier models were not working. And so they kept refining and creating new models to try and find a school model that was the most effective at assimilating Indigenous children. And residential schools was just one of those models and one of the longest models that they used for quite a period of time. And so I was quite surprised to find that when I went into the documents and found these different school models that the Canadian government used on the Blood Reserve. And so I could only speak from the Blood Reserve perspective. I don't know if this is something that happened on other reserves, but on my reserve, there were several different school models.
What maybe talk a little bit about that. What were some of the other models like? Describe them.
Sure. The very first school model that the Canadian government used was day schools, and they were created and put into the villages once the Canadian government confined us to our reserve. So after we signed Treaty 7, we were forced to relocate onto our reserve, and we had different villages that we had on the Blood Reserve. And so we had different religions who came on to the Blood Reserve and opened up day schools and opened them, in the center of these villages. And they didn't really work out because they couldn't get the children to come to the school. So it wasn't mandatory for children to go to school at that time. So children didn't have to go. And even if they did decide to go to the school, they were still living with their family, still speaking their language, still living their culture. So it
What's
wasn't
a day school? Describe a day school for our listeners.
basically what it is that we have today. So it was just a very small, simple square building that the children would go to from 9 to 3 p.m. In the afternoon. So that would have been in school for about 6 hours. And so they were able to go home at the end of the day and live with their family. So it was just something that they would go to school in the day and then come home after.
That's like a regular school then, like what you see today, right?
Yeah, basically.
Were there any other models?
Yeah, after that, the government moved to industrial schools. And so they didn't want the children to have the schools in their villages anymore. And so they made industrial schools that were supposed to be far away from the reserve. And specifically within Treaty 7, they opened up the St. Joseph's and St. Dunstan. Which is more commonly referred to as the Dumbo Industrial School and the Calgary Industrial School. So it would have taken a couple of days to actually get to these schools. So it was quite a distance from the reserve, and they would live there for the rest of their lives until they came of age to return home. And that was something that the government, they thought it would be more successful at assimilating the children because they would no longer be with their families, no longer speaking their language, and having to be there. But it didn't work out because children were lonely. They were running home, and parents were coming and actually trying to take their children back and put them into the day schools because they missed their children. And so it re really wasn't working out. And so the Canadian government had to try and come up with a different school model that still tried to meet their wants of assimilating, but to try and also kind of accommodate parents as well so that they wouldn't come and continue trying to pick up their children from the schools.
I remember, and that kind of explains this the situation where my aunt and a few well, they're elders now. Some of them have passed away, or most of them have passed away. They were gone. They left the reserve. They were sent to, I guess it was an industrial school, as you just described, they were gone for like 5 years, and they never came home the whole time, the whole 5 year period. And that kind of explains the model that you're talking about. I always wondered what that was all about. So it's incredible that they were able to, you know, survive that long being away from their parents and their families and stuff like that. So you're also involved in beading. Yeah, I hear you're a great beader. How does this has it influenced your work, and is there a connection to it, or is this a hobby that you do? Or explain your beadwork and how a little bit about it.
Sure. So my mother taught me how to bead at the age of 5 years old. And so that's something that I really enjoy doing. And when I get extra time, it's something that I like to do, still continue to do in my life right now. I recently published a research paradigm called beadworking a few years ago. And I really wanted to do this. And as an Indigenous person, growing up, you know, I've often been told what I can and cannot do because I'm Indigenous. And now that I'm in academia, I get told by non-Indigenous researchers what I can and cannot do as an Indigenous researcher. And there is this misconception that Indigenous people can only do qualitative research, and that we can't do anything other than doing interviews while we research. And I decided to create this research paradigm in response to being treated in such a manner for Indigenous peoples. I think this disregards our ways of knowing, our ways of being, and our ways of doing. We have, you know, we might not use the same terms, but we have our own science, our own math, our own traditional ecological knowledge, and our knowledge systems are all encompassing. And so, you know, I would argue that as Indigenous peoples, we've been engaging in research our whole lives as peoples. And I wanted to be able to create this research paradigm that says that as Indigenous peoples, we can engage in qualitative and quantitative and mixed method research design. And so I use beadwork as one way to show that Indigenous peoples do have this available to them, as long as it matches our methodology and is grounded within our own knowledge systems. And historically, glass beads is not part of our traditional culture. It was introduced by colonizers. And as Indigenous peoples, we've taken the glass beads and we've used it in a way that's very unique to ourselves as Indigenous peoples. And so the paradigm talks about how we use glass beads in a way that allows us to engage in any type of research that is beneficial to our people. And so I have written about principles of beadwork that I use that helps to guide the research that I conduct.
A while back, I don't know exactly the time period, when the government banned a lot of the ceremonies, the potlatches, and the power dancing, and they, you know, they went about collecting a lot of the regalia, the instruments that Indigenous people used during their ceremonies. And basically, you know, made it illegal for Indigenous people to practice their culture in these various formats. And it's also like, it's also interesting to know that the museum started collecting a lot of artifacts maybe shortly after this period. I think it was around the 30s, 40s, somewhere in that period. And it would all be interesting to know what happened to a lot of this stuff. Maybe it's still stored somewhere in Ottawa, in one of the old buildings that, you know, that store a lot of Indigenous artifacts and materials. What do you think? Would this be a coincidence? Do you think? What's your feelings on this? To take the artifacts and the ceremonial regalia and the stuff they use for potlatches, taken away, and then a museum suddenly starts showing this stuff. Is this a coincidence, or are they tied together?
I think that they're tied together. The Indian Act had started to ban different ceremonies so that we weren't able to live our culture, especially being able to, in the beadworking article that I wrote, being able to even wear our own regalia became illegal. We had to get permission from the Indian agent in order to wear regalia outside of our community. And so we were under these heavy restrictions. And at the same time, we start to see museums who were taking ceremonial objects, anything that had to do with Indigenous people, and them on display in museums across the world. And at the same time, the Canadian government made an amendment to the Indian Act to make it illegal for Indigenous peoples to seek any kind of legal counsel. And so that made it that when if something was stolen, that we did not have any way to seek legal counsel to get those items back. And I actually had one of my great-great-grandfathers, his regalia was stolen and put into a museum. And we couldn't do anything about it because of the Indian Act. And it wouldn't be until 1951 that the Canadian government repealed that. And so when that came out of the Indian Act, my grandfather hired a lawyer to try and get back our ancestors' regalia. And it took a number of years, and we actually didn't get all of the regalia back. They kept about half the regalia outfit. And I had an opportunity to go and visit that museum before COVID hit. And I searched everywhere in that museum looking for my ancestors' regalia, and they didn't even have it on display. And I found that so disappointing that, they wouldn't give the regalia back to my family, and it's not even on display in the museum.
Yeah, an archives here in Ottawa. Actually, there's a couple of them that store treaties, documents, and other historical artifacts pertaining to Indigenous people. And we've had the privilege of making arrangements to go and see some of the artifacts. Not the artifacts, more like the treaties, the original documents. And it's such an amazing place. I mean, just paintings and the treaties alone, we were only just allowed to see that part of it. But I can imagine there must be thousands of artifacts stored, within that building. It's a huge, huge building. So I was kind of I was very, very interested and fascinated by that whole area of Indigenous artifacts being, taken away, and whatever happened to them, they got to be somewhere, right? Stored somewhere. When we're talking about powwows and when the government started banning potlatches and Indigenous cultural ceremonies, I go now to powwows and there's still that colonialism attitude by even our people, Indigenous people, where you're not allowed to film or take photographs of certain powwow dances, and you ask people why, they don't really give you a reason why. But I think it has to do with back in the day when you did dance, people did dance powwows. When it was illegal, right? After they made it illegal to do ceremonies and power dancing and those kinds of activities. So that's probably where that comes from. Like, they probably banned anybody from taking photographs because it would be like evidence that can be used against the community or the people actually doing the dances. Your work is very interesting, and what you do is very interesting. And you also did a exhibition at the Galt Museum and Archives in Alberta. The name of the exhibition is Stolen Kainai Children: Stories of Survival. This exhibition focuses on the residential school era, but also on the resiliency of the Blood Tribe I'm wondering if you can speak more about this exhibition and your knowledge about it.
Sure. So I've spent nearly a decade of my life researching the history of colonization on the Blood Reserve, specific to the colonial school system. And as I've mentioned, my mother is a survivor of the residential school system. And in one of the conversations that I had with her, my mother was asking me questions, and she asked me, "Is that what happened?" And I realized that my mother had spent her entire life not really understanding the policies about why this happened to her, why she was in those schools, what the policy was while she was attending school. And I started to have other conversations with tribal members and even people outside of my tribe. And this seemed to be a common experience for everybody, that they never understood why. Nobody ever explained the policies and why this was happening to them. And
Right.
so I do a lot of presentations on the research that I'm doing. And a comment that I get is that in some ways it provides closure for those who attended residential school, because they have an understanding of why this has happened to them. And so for the museum exhibit, I really wanted to be able to offer that to other survivors, to be able to come to the exhibit and to learn about those policies so that they understand what has happened to them. And that goes along with one of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action, where Indigenous peoples are able to and know and understand what happened to them and why in these schools. And so I was really very happy when the Galt Museum and Archives approached me to create this museum exhibit based on my research. And so I tailored it in the way that I did, because I wanted to be able to provide one way for survivors to learn the truth about what happened to them and why. And so in the museum exhibit, I talk about the different school models that I was sharing with you earlier. And I go through each of the school models with its corresponding educational policy. But I've worked with a group of elders who share stories with each of these school models. And that speaks to our experience as Blackfoot people, as well as our resilience as we've gone through that and survived. And so I wanted to also share that with the rest of Canada so that they understand what has happened to Indigenous peoples, because it's a part of history that never gets taught, and we need to do better in teaching it and getting information out there that's the truth and correct for Canadians to understand what has happened.
Ayaya songs are about our histories. Ayaya is an Inuit-owned firm that tells our stories in many languages across Canada. They are experts in publishing children's books, usually in syllabics, and they also do large multi-language projects like the reports of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission. If you need help getting your stories into classrooms or homes in Cree, Inuktitut, or other Indigenous languages, check them out at ayaya.ca. That's ayaya.ca.
Right. We have listeners on this podcast from pretty much all over the world now. A lot of people don't, have not been even aware that there were residential schools. A lot of people, kept quiet about it, and the government kept quiet about it and didn't really talk about it with the Canadian public. I would like you to, for our listeners, and I would like you to, if you can, explain what the purpose of the residential schools was, so that people will understand what it was all about, why there were residential schools, and what was the intent behind them.
Right. So the intent behind residential schools was to completely rid the Canadian population of Indigenous peoples. And that was written into the Indian Acts. And the way that the Canadian government decided to try and tackle this was to do it through the children. So they took the most vulnerable population in Canada and tried to destroy them. The Indian Act was written the way that it was to try and assimilate Indigenous peoples. They didn't concentrate on our elders or our older population because they felt like in a couple of generations, all of our elders would die off, our language would die off, our ways of knowing and being would die off. And they were hoping to teach the children to be like the rest of Canada and not follow in our traditions, not follow in our language. And so they really, really concentrated on the children and had so many rules, so many policies within these school systems to try and have children become like of Canada. And so the Canadian government felt that within a few generations of having these schools open, that we would no longer have Indigenous peoples within a few generations. And that was something that didn't happen. As Indigenous peoples, we are still here today. We still have our languages. We still have our ways of knowing, being, and doing, but we've been living with the trauma of what colonization has done to us. And that is something why we need truth and reconciliation so that we can heal together as a nation.
Very well said. Before I let you go, I want to ask you a couple more questions. What has been your community's response to the work that you do, Kainai Blood Tribe? Has it been positive or negative? I'm sure it's been positive response.
Yes, it has been positive, very supportive of the work that I'm doing, and I'm trying to get out the work that I'm doing as much as I can to my people. But again, our traditional territory is very large. And so I've been trying to share my research in a variety of ways. And so this exhibit is just one way that I've been trying to share my knowledge. And so I have high hopes of being able to create the exhibit into a traveling exhibit so that I'm able to reach more people, reach more of my Blackfoot people, as well as the rest of Canada. And I hope to also go internationally with the exhibit as well, because internationally, Europeans also helped in funding residential schools historically. And so this is something not just that Canada needs to reconcile with, it's outside of Canada as well that we need to reconcile what has happened to Indigenous peoples within Canada.
Why is the process of the truth and reconciliation important for all Canadians to be a part of? What is your hope for the future generations?
I think the process of truth and reconciliation is important for all Canadians to be a part of, because it allows us to come to a collective understanding and acknowledgement of the historical injustices and traumas that have been inflicted upon Indigenous peoples by the Canadian government, by colonizers who've come and settled upon these lands. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions that I've learned through the research that I've been conducting is that many Canadians believe that colonization is something that happened once and took place in the past. And that colonization is something that benefits everybody. But colonization didn't happen like that. Colonization is a structure, and it means that colonization is ongoing. And it is something that Indigenous peoples have to face every single day of their lives. As Indigenous peoples, we're constantly asked to just get over it. But if Canadians actually understood how colonization works and how it continues to negatively affect Indigenous peoples daily, I don't think that we would be asked to just get over it anymore. And that's why truth-telling is so important, that we need Canadians to engage in. And as Indigenous peoples, I feel like we are often shamed for the present circumstances that we find ourselves in. And Canadians need to understand why we are in the situations that we are in. And so, you know, some of these situations include having lower employment rates, higher incarceration rates, lower education rates, lower life expectancy, higher chronic health issues. And we didn't do this to ourselves. This is legislation that has been written through the Indian Act to try and eradicate Indigenous peoples from Canada. We didn't introduce these policies to ourselves that have had a lasting and damaging effects upon generations of Indigenous peoples. Instead, you know, this is something, colonization is something that we've been trying to survive for over a century. And we need to be able to change the structures of oppression that are entrenched in Canadian society so that Indigenous peoples have an opportunity to heal. And we can't do it alone. We need allies and we need Canadians to care about us. We need help to make these changes where we can be in a place where we can thrive instead of just surviving from colonization. And that's why it's really important that the rest of Canada actively engages in truth and reconciliation, because we need Canadians to help contribute to healing from this intergenerational trauma that has been caused by colonization, the oppressive structures that colonization has built that the rest of Canadians benefit from, while at the expense of Indigenous peoples. And so we need the rest of Canada to help promote a more inclusive and equitable society for all. And it helps the rest of Canada to be able to learn about Indigenous peoples and hopefully foster greater empathy and understanding, and will lead to reconciliation between Indigenous peoples and the rest of Canada. And so ultimately, I hope that the process of engaging in truth and reconciliation will build a more just, respectful, and harmonious society in Canada where all of us can thrive, not just some of us.
Thank you. Absolutely well said. So proud of you. I've been talking to Dr. Tiffany Heinbull, Reet, from the Kainai Blood Tribe of the Blackfoot Confederacy in Southern Alberta. Thank you so much on behalf of the Legacy Hope Foundation and Roots and Hoots. Thank you for joining us and being here with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
Awesome, awesome. Equacy.
Roots and Hoots is a podcast project produced by the Legacy of Hope Foundation. For episode show notes, please visit the podcast description and make sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review. For more information about the work we do, please visit legacyofhope.ca.